Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right. Please be seated. Except for Justice Kurofsky, who may be standing because she has some back issues, that it serves her better to be standing. Don't make anything of it other than that's her comfort zone right now.
May I say she's a justice outstanding.
Yes, you may say that.
Oh, that's right. All right. Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay, back to business. State versus Robert Jerry Spencer, 18 AP 942. Appearances. Good morning. All right.
Followed by 25 minutes. Followed by 5 minutes, followed by 5 minutes. A little different this morning, right? Okay, so that's your lineup. Let's proceed.
May it please the court. I am Attorney John Grau. I do represent the defendant, Mr. Robert Spencer. And with the court's permission, I'd like to begin addressing a Sixth Amendment issue that we raised in our briefs, and that is that our claim that the trial court violated Mr. Spencer's right to counsel by having an ex parte meeting with a juror after the close of evidence that resulted in the juror's ultimate discharge from the case. To begin, I'd just like to quote a little law here. An accused has a right to counsel at every critical stage of a trial, and one of the issues in this case, obviously, is was that meeting between the judge and the juror a critical stage of the trial? Broadly, a critical stage has been defined as a stage where a defendant has a right to counsel whenever he or she needs help dealing with legal problems. That's State v. Kohler, Wisconsin case, Bell case, United States Supreme Court case, put it in terms of a stage of the proceeding that has significant consequences for the accused.
So, Attorney Grau, if we said that this was a critical stage, what do you need once it's a critical stage? Do you just need meaningful participation with the attorney? And the question then is, was this that? Was the ability to ask questions that were then asked to the juror, even though not ideal and not the way we want judges to do it, but was it meaningful enough for Sixth Amendment purposes?
I mean, are you asking if the attorney's participation at the critical stage was sufficient?
Right. If we say it's a critical stage, where does that leave us? Why wasn't the participation sufficient?
Because basically it was a fact-finding 45 minutes or 30. We don't know from the record exactly how long this went. But the purpose of the stage was to meet, apparently, the judge met with the juror to determine whether the juror was sick enough to be dismissed for cause. That would be the legal issue in that meeting. Could this juror be dismissed for cause? And so that was important to my client, whether or not that juror was dismissed for reasons that are evident in the briefs. It was the only African-American juror on the jury, and that was significant to my client. The purpose of the meeting was to determine whether or not this juror would be dismissed, and counsel was not a part of that meeting.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. Did counsel ask if they could question the juror directly? Because counsel could have... Couldn't we say that the counsel was a part of it in that counsel asked questions for the judge to then ask the juror? And what should we make of the fact that counsel didn't say, can I please question the juror?
We don't know what counsel said or didn't say. None of this was on the record. That's the problem in the case.
Well, did counsel ask to question the juror?
Not directly, that we know of. The counsel did not ask directly any questions of the juror. In fact, I did put in the motion that I filed post-conviction because it was unclear, really, from the record. I put in there that counsel had said no. At no time did we meet with the juror. So there was, in the transcript, there is reference by the court to one question somewhere along the line of this meeting between the court and the juror. The counsel asked one question about whether or not stress had anything to do with this because of the fact that she was an African-American juror. And the record shows that the court, after it came out and was explaining what happened, said, I asked the juror something along the lines of what counsel said. We don't even know exactly how that question was worded to the juror. But the answer, according to the judge, was the juror said, no, that has nothing to do with it. I don't have those words exactly right. But so there was apparently one communication to the juror by the judge in response to one question that was posed by the defense counsel. But we don't know when that happened, where in the scheme of things, how long the judge had already been talking to the juror. The break in the trial when this discussion took place was a break at the close of evidence. The judge said he was going to go off the record, was going to get some verdict forms, if I remember. So it wasn't even a break, a heads up that we're talking to a juror. There's an issue here with a juror. 45 minutes later, back on the record, we have the statement of the judge as far as what happened. So we don't really have anything in between there. So we're saying that that is a critical stage. I know that the state is saying it's not a critical stage. I think the majority of the cases in this state would indicate that that is a critical stage. It's been found to be a critical stage at voir dire, if there's a communication between a judge and a jury during the trial, post-trial, verdicts.
Counsel, let's say it is a critical stage, okay? Then the next step in the analysis, if it was error to not have the attorney present, was the error, harmless? The state posits that the test, the inquiry for that really, is whether or not the absence of the attorney would a possibility that the absence of an attorney would affect the outcome of the trial. Seems like that's a pretty tough thing to prove. To prove a negative is always difficult.
Right, and I think that's very tough to prove if you get to the point where you decide that the harmless error analysis is appropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, we have argued that this should be treated as structural error.
Yes, I understand that.
A starting point for structural error is this court's statement in Anderson that ordinarily the absence of counsel at a critical stage of a proceeding is not subject to harmless error analysis. So I think that's the starting point for the law. So this would be an exception to that for this communication with the juror. And then the overall purpose of structural error has been described SMH, that's a termination of parental rights case out of...
Yes, I understand that. I understand also a case or two has been cited that it may not apply in the same way in this kind of a fact situation. Nevertheless,
right.
I want to get to harmless error, and I want to get to the test that the state posits. Can you meet the test, or is that not an appropriate test? Help me with that, if you will.
Well, there's a couple ways you can look at the test. First of all, the defendant doesn't have to meet the test. It's the state's burden to prove harmless error, if that is going to be the test. And what I think was done in the Court of Appeals here is contrary to that whole idea that the state proves harmless error, when the Court of Appeals basically said you had a fair jury anyways. So we don't have to go any further than that. I did cite at length a decision, Hinton, because they say it better than I do. Why that doesn't make sense, why that's wrong. At the beginning of a trial, when you're doing voir dire, you're concerned with, are these jurors going to be able to approach the case fairly and objectively? After you hear evidence, the question is, how are these jurors going to view the evidence they heard? That's different. So the question isn't just, do we have a fair jury now? The question is, what would this juror, the replacement juror, how would that juror have viewed the evidence? So the state, I think, is proposing a test, because they haven't, the state in this court has not really relied, I don't think, the way I read the briefs, on the idea that, oh, we had a fair jury, that's the end of it.
Mr. Grau, in your analysis,
I'm sorry.
This is where I'm getting confused, because what I hear you arguing is harmless error as it relates to the juror being dismissed. And isn't the issue here the ex parte communication?
Right.
I get that one led to the other, but they're two different. They're different.
Right. No, I understand. And the first question then in a harmless error might be, if counsel had been present, would the juror have been retained or excused?
Well,
so could the state prove, as part of its harmless error, that counsel's presence did not result in the dismissal, or if counsel had been present, the juror would have been retained?
And I think that's a really good question, and I want to hear you answer that, because in my mind, having presided over a number of trials, and as I'm sure you know, as a judge, a circuit court judge, you're taking care of a lot of people in the courtroom, including the jurors. It's not good when you have a sick juror. If you've got a sick juror in a room with 12 other people, then you're really starting to get worried as a trial court judge, right? Like, you don't want everyone else to get sick,
sure.
Right? And you're just like, as a human being, when someone is sick, you want to make sure they're okay. I just don't understand what defense counsel in this case was going to do about the fact that this juror was sick, and what questioning this juror, how that was going to change anything.
Well, we don't know, and that's the problem, because none of this was on the record. And all we have regarding how sick the juror was is that she was feeling queasy, lightheaded, and I think the word was, and there's a reminisce of something that happened she's had for a week or so. This was a 5-day trial. If counsel had been in there and had been able to, if counsel had been involved and there was a record made, and it showed, yes, this juror is sick, very sick. We don't know how sick this juror. We don't know if it could have been continued for another hour, which I don't think is unreasonable given the circumstances to wait. She's apparently lying down somewhere, if I remember correctly. But we just don't know. And that's, we're taking at face value the judge's statement that the juror was too sick to proceed. But we don't know that.
So that's the issue that you have here, is that taking at face value what the judge was saying.
I mean, and that's
and that you think that had the attorney had the opportunity to be in there and ask some questions of the juror, that something would have happened other than the juror being allowed to go home? There's a disconnect for me there.
Well, but I understand, but that is the point. We don't know, and that's one of the problems. There wasn't a court reporter taken in. If the record showed unequivocally, this juror was too sick to proceed. We don't know what the illness was. We don't know what it was. If it was a headache, just what the situation was. But that is where counsel would have a chance to explore that and make sure. There are cases where jurors start feeling lightheaded during trial and pauses are taken, and they're given time to recover. I know that that's happened. I don't know why that couldn't have happened here. Maybe it couldn't have, but we just don't know. And under Lehman, one of the things you want to do is have a court reporter in there and counsel whenever there's a communication. So we're not in this position of trying to guess how sick this juror was. And you know, that gets me into a little, I'm not going to get into this right now, but you know, there were some statements made by the judge in addition to whether or not the juror was sick as reasons why the juror was being dismissed, which makes you wonder, well, how sick was the juror? I mean, if there's more to it than that. We just don't know. And that's one of the reasons why we try to argue that it is structural error, because you just can't, you don't know what's going on here. And since you can't figure that out, we can't figure out a test for harmless error.
So if the juror had been sicker, then would your argument, would you be able to make your, what if the juror was throwing up all over the place? What if the juror tested positive for COVID on a rapid test? What if,
sure.
I mean,
oh, interrupt.
Right, no, I don't, well, I know.
Sorry.
You weren't saying that because you were excited because someone tested positive. No, I understand. But so I guess my point is, are you asking us to, it sounds like you're making a distinction between being queasy or possibly having a headache and being full on, really, really throwing up. And I don't know, where are we supposed to draw that line?
Well, this is where. If the judge had even consulted with the attorneys and had them come in and talk with the juror, and it was explained, they don't have to question. I know there's a concern about maybe the attorneys not acting appropriately, or that was raised something in front of the juror. Don't want to inhibit the fact-finding process by having attorneys present. Well, the last thing an attorney wants to do is get a juror mad. I mean, you just don't want to do that when you're trying a case. So I think the attorney should have been involved, should have gone in there. And if it's evident that this juror is sick as can be, no attorney is going to say, I want this juror on my case. It's just not going to happen. But we don't know what happened. If the juror had thrown up and everybody knew it, I'm sure the parties would have agreed to go with an alternate. But we don't know any of that. All we have is lightheaded and queasy. And is that sufficient to discharge a juror when counsel, even if that was sufficient, counsel should have been in there. But I'm saying, no, that's a situation where counsel should have been involved, should have been able to test the juror, see if the juror really was too sick to proceed, because this was a very important juror for this defendant. He's got a right to try to keep on a case, a juror that he wants on the case. I hope I've...
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
She also could have been drawn as an alternate, you know.
I know.
There were 13 jurors, and you have to do it by random, but it's not necessarily the case that she would stay on the case, even if she continued.
I understand that. And the Court of Appeals pointed that out in their decision and didn't address that. Odds are, I'm not a betting guy, but odds are she would have been on the case.
One choice out of 13.
Right. One thing I did, you know, I did want to talk about a little bit. I know I went straight to harmless error. I just did want to talk a little bit about why we think structural error should apply in a situation like this. Because this is the dismissal of this juror is not the kind of thing that is easily evaluated for harmless error. Just what effect does this have on the case? It's really very hard to tell. And just some considerations. The Weaver court that says the analysis is not rigid. Question is, does the error go to the trial framework or presentation of the case to the jury? This error, in our opinion, goes to the framework of the trial. Is it hard to measure the effect? Yes. What's the importance of the interest affected? Well, the interest affected here, it wasn't a statutory violation. It was a constitutional right to have your attorney present at a critical stage. And that in itself is an interest worthy of protection apart from the right to an impartial jury. I mean, if we say we're going to judge whether or not there was error here, harmless error, by the fact of a jury being impartial, we're really giving no remedy to what happened with the Sixth Amendment violation. The defendant would have to prove another violation of another constitutional right to get any kind of relief. So I think it's really appropriate to say this is structural error. It goes to the jury, who was on the jury, which is a fundamental fairness issue in a trial case. All right, going over these cases on that issue again, I was struck by the decisions out of this court, Anderson and Burton. And it's not lost on me. Anderson was a case where there was a lot of notes going back and forth between the judge and the jury. There were a lot of issues in the case. Ultimately, counsel was not involved in any of the discussion. At the end of the trial, court and a guilty verdict, the court informed the parties what had happened. Obviously, there was an appeal. On that issue, there seemed to be a finding that it was presumed prejudice because there was no record. And I took note of the fact that Justice Rogenczyk dissented from that. And I just wanted to address that a little bit. Justice Rogenczyk discussed, that case overruled what's called the Hefner case, if I recall, where it was automatic. If there was a critical stage and there was absence of counsel, it was automatically reversed. And then there was the Burton case after that, where in a situation with a communication between the court and the jury said, no, not in all cases, we don't have to apply that strict rule, the Hefner rule. We can do harmless error at times. And I know the dissent said in that case, basically, we can look at the facts and decide whether this was harmless error or not. And the dissent also indicated that the rule now is that we apply harmless error to communications between a judge and jury. And so I went back, and I was reading that over again, and I read the Burton case. And the reason for overturning Hefner, as I understand it, was that, this was the wording, situations will inevitably arise in which the communication is so innocuous that it cannot be said that the error in any way influenced the jury's verdict. So there was like an unforeseen situation that can come up in the future. We don't have that. I think, you know, with all due respect, I think the dissent goes the other way and doesn't take into account. We could have fact situations where it would be appropriate with a communication to the jury to not have a structural error. I mean, to use structural error and not to have a harmless error analysis. And I think this is one of those cases. This is not a case with a typical communication between a court and a juror about things you can easily check on whether the jury instructions were correct, whether the evidence should be submitted or not. This goes to the makeup of the jury, and it was a fact-finding hearing, more or less, not just a communication of law, which is different. So I think this is the type of case where it should be found that the error is structural. And because of the facts, because of the situation, and because of all the things I've been talking about with Justice Karofsky, how we just don't know what happened and how serious the illness was, all of that. But getting back to the question of harmless error, if the court does go that way, it is, as I said, one view, we said the harm here was the dismissal of the juror. And could the state show that that juror would have been dismissed anyways if counsel had been present? That's one way to view what should be evaluated for harmless error. And in fact, I think the state in its brief mentioned at some point that we couldn't show that counsel would have made a difference. But if you're talking harmless error, it's not our burden to show anything. That's just not our burden. And what Justice Karofsky was talking about, the idea, are we going to look, and what Justice Rogensack mentioned in the dissent I was referencing, are we just going to look at the facts of the case and decide based on that? And I did address, you know, I referenced in my brief the Hinton case where they did do that. You know, did look at the facts and decide, no, it's not harmless error. Said it would be rare to find harmless error in a case like that, because the evidence would have to be so overwhelming that we're convinced a different juror wouldn't make a difference. Hinton was not a constitutional violation, however. That was just an erroneous exercise of discretion case. Violation of a statute. I think a juror was determined by the judge to maybe be, not quite with it, paying attention mentally, had some mental issues. So they did do that type of analysis and found it was not harmless error. So if we get to that point here, I won't go through all the facts of the case, but there are some things I'd just like to address as far as the state argues regarding the facts and why they believe it is overwhelming evidence. And two items really stick out. The idea that all these identifiers are found at the scene places my client at the scene. His car is there. Testimony was that his van was loaned to TM. My client was seen with TM at his sister's house 5 hours before this incident. Now, if TM is using the van, it's been loaned to him, that explains why the van is at the scene. It also explains why the van is still at the scene after TM is shot. So the other main point was that it was raised that allegedly RS, the victim of the robbery, had told TM's sister prior to telling the police that it was my client who was involved. If you look at the sister's testimony, though, well, first of all, RS on the stand said, no, my sisters told me who was involved. And if you look at the testimony, two sisters testified. And they had talked. And one of them had known that 5 hours before this, my client was with TM. There is no doubt they talked to each other. It's also in the record. They talked to each other. It certainly would have come up who their brother was with the day he was shot. There certainly could have been a conversation between them later on when the sisters are talking to RS that, hey, this Spencer guy, he's the one he was with. And so, da, da, da. So that is, it's plausible, like RS testified, that his sister told him it was Spencer. And there's no doubt R.S., when he was being interviewed by the police, was afraid that he was going to get charged with shooting T.M. He was questioned whether he had a gun. R.S. testified on the stand. He denied my client was involved. He gave reasons why he lied. And this was his only testimony under oath. It was at trial. And to say that his prior statements constitute overwhelming evidence of guilt, I believe that's an impossible burden to reach. And I think I threw in that case Hobbs, because the facts seem so similar to what we have as far as, you know, a recantation by a witness. And can you have harmless error in such a situation like that? Our opinion is no. This is just not harmless error. You can't go on the facts of the case and say there would have been a conviction anyways. So I see my warning light is on. I didn't address the issue. Well, there were two other issues really involved in the case. The state has a petition for review on the remand from the Court of Appeals for a Mockner hearing. We did file an ineffective assistance of counsel motion. We were alleging that there was hearsay that was admitted that should not have been. It was basically that, getting into this, I'm sure it would take quite a while. I see my red light is on, so I will stop at that point if that's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm sensing a little skepticism today, maybe with my right to counsel argument, but I'm going to give it a shot. We don't believe that Mr. Spencer was denied his right to counsel at a critical stage. And I want to start by saying this. If counsel hadn't been involved at all in the decision to excuse Juror 2 for cause, I wouldn't be standing here arguing that there was no constitutional violation.
Then it must be a critical stage, right? Why do you have to go to that extreme to make your argument? Isn't your better argument the argument of what the consequence is? Because how do we say all of a sudden it's not a critical stage? He's got it right from the beginning to the end. This is an important part of jury participation or selection. So why would we all of a sudden say that's not a critical stage?
I think to me, the critical stage here is the issue surrounding Juror 2's cause, right? That's a legal issue that Mr. Spencer needed help dealing with. But I think the way they're looking at this is to, and this is something that happened in the Schmidt v. Foster case, the Seventh Circuit case we cited in our brief, it's almost like they're saying there's a critical stage within a critical stage. Because he's not disputing that on the broad issue of Juror 2's excusal for cause, he didn't have advocacy. He plainly did. The attorney was able to ask a question for the juror. The attorney was involved in the decision to wait some time to see if the juror would feel better. The attorney had every opportunity to ask for a continuance or to object to the juror's excusal for cause. She moved for a mistrial after the court's ruling, and she renewed an earlier objection that she had made to the racial composition of the jury pool. That is advocacy, plain and simple, and it distinguishes this case from every case cited in the party's briefs where courts either found a right to counsel violation or they assumed one. So this is a very unique set of circumstances, is what I'm saying, both because of counsel's participation on the substantive legal issue, but also because this was a delicate situation. This was a sick juror. This is somebody who was laying down in the jury room before she even said anything to the bailiff. And the suggestion here today is that defense counsel should have been able to probe this juror on her symptoms, on her ability to proceed, on whether her illness was a pretext. And I'm saying I think that context matters when this court decides whether what happened here crossed the constitutional line.
Well, how would you want us to word this, though, in terms of a rule coming out of this case, given that we wouldn't want to give the message to trial judges that they should? Do you agree that they should have had an opportunity to have this on the record? I mean, shouldn't we be telling, haven't we always told judges that? Wouldn't we want to continue to tell judges that? And so how would the rule in this case, how would we carefully craft it so that we wouldn't be indicating that this isn't something that should be on the record?
Sure. So I think you're right. Best practices, generally speaking, we are saying that when a court meets with a juror, particularly during deliberations, this court's precedent's pretty clear that if a juror contacts someone during deliberation, or excuse me, if the court contacts a juror during deliberations, counsel should be present. But what I would say is, if you're asking for somewhat of a limiting principle here, United States v. Wade, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case, the court said if there's minimal risk that counsel's absence might derogate from the defendant's right to a fair trial, it's not a critical stage. And I think that's what we have here. I think we have a very small chance that during the alleged critical stage, which is these ex parte communications about the juror's symptoms, her ability to proceed, I think there's a very small chance that counsel would have gained any kind of insight that would have assisted Mr. Spencer in his you know, defense of or this substantive issue of juror 2's excusal for cause. What are the odds that had counsel been in the room when the juror was asked about her symptoms, suddenly her symptoms wouldn't be, I'm queasy, I'm lightheaded, I've been experiencing issues for a week, and she would have just said, well, I just have a bit of a headache.
Well, couldn't counsel have said something like, you know, I know you're not feeling well, I heard you're not feeling well, you made this commitment to be on this jury. We really respect that and understand how important that is. Do you really think you could see this through? And maybe she would have said, yeah, you know, you're right. I've been feeling kind of queasy all week, but I can see this through. I mean, wouldn't that have happened?
I just don't see the difference between a person of authority asking that juror that question and defense counsel asking that juror that question and the odds that the answer would be any different if it came from defense counsel. And I do want to say I do think it's relevant. We've cited a couple cases to show that it is relevant whether counsel's presence might be counterproductive. And I am suggesting that, you know, the words that Mr. Spencer used in his brief is that counsel should have been able to thoroughly explore the juror's symptoms, her illness, thoroughly explore whether it was a pretext. That sounds a little bit like cross-examination to me. And I think this could have backfired if the juror, who by all accounts was sick and was feeling unwell, felt like she had to stay on this jury. We could be standing here for a different reason, because the jury may want to, you know, quickly deliberate and get out of there. So I'm just saying I think it's relevant, and I think the context today is very important in keeping in mind in terms of analyzing this issue.
Go ahead.
You indicated in your response the odds are. So I want to take a look at those odds. I see that Mr. Gao is not a betting man, he said, but apparently you are. And I want to take the odds are and superimpose that on the burden you have to show that, assuming this was error, and you're not arguing that, conceding that, but assuming this is error, and that you get to the harmless error test, what is that test as applied to this, and what are the odds? I think part of the test is a reasonable possibility. So that's what perked up my ears when you said the odds are, because it is a reasonable possibility. 10%, 20%, what is your burden to show that it did not affect the outcome of the trial?
Well, I'll start by saying, obviously, we clearly understand it's our burden to show harmless error. The other thing I would note is there's a lot of talk of, well, this is speculation, that we shouldn't even do a harmless error analysis. All harmless error analyses require some speculation. It's a question of whether it's guided speculation or unguided speculation. For example, unguided speculation would be a situation like defendants denied his right to counsel of choice. There, it's really hard to determine how things would have shaped out had another lawyer litigated the case. That's unguided speculation. We say that's structural error. In this situation, we have guided speculation. I'm relying on a lot of the facts in the record here.
What is the test, and how have you met it?
I think that I'll start by saying this. There is precedent supporting the idea that for harmless error, the only question this court needs to ask is whether the remaining jurors were impartial. There is precedent supporting that. Court of Appeals cited to state, I think it's Mendoza is the case. As Mr. Spencer pointed out, that is a different set of circumstances that deals with the removal of a prospective juror, and he's trying to distinguish it in that, well, this is a situation where you had a juror sitting and listening to the evidence. But if you take a look at State v. Avery, it's another case we cited in our brief, that is a situation more analogous to the facts of this case. I should have discussed it more in my brief, where the juror in Avery, deliberations had started. Late at night, the juror asked to be removed from the jury. The court winds up having an ex parte communication with the juror and later memorializes the discussion. The Court of Appeals in that case assumed error and ran a harmless error analysis, and that analysis was limited to whether the remaining jurors were impartial that deliberated on his case. So I do think there is precedent. I'm not relying on it solely. Well, I should say this, Justice Bradley. This court has used different language in talking about harmless error. And a lot of times in the
that's understatement.
And so I'm doing my best. But, you know, sometimes it's phrased as, do you, like, ultimate inquiry, do you lack confidence in the outcome? And if that's the ultimate question, I think if you look and you say, well, there were 12 impartial jurors that deliberated on this case, I think.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting, but I'm missing something. What are you advancing is the test here, and how have you met it?
Well, I'm trying to say that I think that there's different options for this court.
What are you advancing?
Okay. I would say that the test is, which we commonly see, a reasonable possibility of a different outcome. So the question to me, and this is the analysis I ran in my brief, not just the impartiality of the jurors, a reasonable possibility that had defense counsel been in the room for these ex parte communications, a reasonable possibility of a different outcome. To me, that's a two-step analysis in this case. We know how the jury comes out without juror two on the jury, right? So to me, to show a reasonable possibility of a different outcome, you'd first have to show a reasonable possibility that juror two would have stayed on the jury.
Don't you have to show the negative of that? There is not a reasonable possibility.
It is my burden. I think we're kind of maybe splitting hairs on how we look at it. But I think my position is, and to be clear, I don't think that the state is speculating. We're relying on plenty of facts in the record to say there's no reasonable possibility that had defense counsel been in that room for those discussions that anything would have changed in terms of this juror being excused for cause. You look at the record, she's laying down in the jury room before she even contacts the bailiff. She's got to lay down in chambers because she's feeling so unwell. She's been experiencing issues for about a week. She describes her symptoms. She's asked whether this illness is a pretext. I think that was a fair question to ask, a good question to ask. And the court was satisfied with her response. The other thing I would point to, and we noted this in a footnote, I think, is that juror two, this specific juror, was asked during voir dire whether she would feel uncomfortable being the only black juror on the jury. And her answer, I think, is important and empowering, which is that I was raised to speak my mind, so I will speak my mind. I think that helps go to show that she was being honest about the fact that she didn't feel well. And I don't think anything would have changed had defense counsel been in the room. And I know I did in my brief say Mr. Spencer hasn't come up with any ideas. I'm not trying to shift the burden. I'm just trying to say, based on the facts we have, I just can't think of what could have possibly happened in that room that would have changed the outcome.
So is it that the remaining jurors would be impartial? Can you connect that to what you just said for me? Or are those different analytically, or how do those fit together?
Could you maybe be more specific? I forget what I just said.
Yeah.
Here, well, I'll read it back just a minute.
Well, you had said earlier that there's precedent for the idea that the harmless error looks like are the remaining jurors impartial. Then you just said that there'd be no reasonable possibility that had defense counsel been present in the room that the juror would not have been relieved for cause. Those are not the same question, I think. So I'm trying to figure out the link that you're making. Are those different? And I understand you're dealing with this is a unique situation, so we're trying to figure it out. But and maybe you have different ways of framing it. But help us make that connection.
And I am kind of dragging my feet on taking a side on this. But I would say, just because I think there's precedent supporting both, what I would say is this: I did find persuasive in the case that Mr. Spencer cited, the Hinton case, where they talk about a situation where maybe you have a sign in the record that the juror that's excused or removed, maybe you have some sign that he or she would have dissented. And in that situation, we might be able to say a reasonable possibility of a different outcome. And I think that's why I'm hesitant to just say the question should just be whether the remaining jurors were impartial, as opposed to taking a more fact-specific approach to the analysis. So since you're pressing me, I would say I think we should go with the reasonable possibility of a different outcome approach that I just took and that I took in my brief in terms of the two steps.
And the different outcome that you're, that to be more specific about that, is whether the juror would have been dismissed or not.
Well, I think that's a good question, and that is something that I struggled with preparing for this. When we say reasonable outcome is the outcome of the trial.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so, but in this case, I mean, I think if we said the outcome is the outcome of the trial, you'd still factor in reasonable possibility of whether you could keep the juror on this jury.
I mean, that's probably why there's cases that talk about whether the remaining jurors would have been impartial, because there's some sense that an impartial jury is going to, you know, you're not going to get a different outcome.
Correct.
From the same
yeah.
impartial jury, right, to the trial. So, but those are different questions. Whether the jury would have been dismissed, mm-hmm. it still doesn't get you a new trial necessarily. And at the end of the day, harmless error is looking about errors infecting the process altogether, such that a conviction, you know, or the proceedings should, you know, can't be trusted, right?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, perhaps it's just because it's such a unique set of circumstances, which is why I think in this situation, we're not just asked. I mean, to get to a reasonable possibility of a different outcome, I think you've got to break it down into steps. Can you keep the juror two on the jury, even if she is kept on the juror? Is there a reasonable possibility that she would have dissented? I think that's the analysis.
Or that the jury would have been more impartial with her on it.
Well, I think
that'd be like Hinton.
I'm not sure I follow. I mean, we're presuming all these.
And then the juror, there was a showing that the juror might have dissented.
There were notes. I think in Hinton, the juror had submitted notes to one of the police officers who testified, and there was just an indication that she wasn't buying it.
There's no right to have any particular 12 people, so that's why I'm trying to get at why if one person's going to be gone. And what makes it more impartial, making sure this person's not gone?
I don't know if it's making it more impartial. It's, I think, at least from Mr. Spencer's perspective, it's just this idea that if you have a set of jurors that sit and listen to the evidence, everybody brings their unique insight into a jury room, obviously. Everyone's going to maybe weigh or look at the evidence differently. And I think their position is, in a certain circumstance, that should matter, and maybe we shouldn't just be looking at the people that stayed on the jury. If that makes sense.
I think so. Okay.
And you're not.
I'm not. Justice Hagedorn asked about the two tests that you mentioned. You are advancing in your brief anyway, as I read it at page 30. The reasonable possibility as opposed to impartial jury. The dissent said that both the majority and I think would say you're conflating jury impossible. What did the dissent say? That you're conflating the right to counsel and the right to an impartial jury. And it sounds a little bit like your argument in response to Justice Hagedorn, where you were hitting both impartial jury and then reasonable possibility of a different outcome. So this is a tough case for me, and I am concerned about conflation that the dissent brings up. So can you address that?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that logic. I think from my perspective, I'm stuck with this precedent that seems to suggest two possibilities for analyzing this. And I'm trying to be straightforward with, you know, what the law says and where I think, I mean, I think this is just a rare set of circumstances. I understand the argument of we don't want to be saying he has to prove an additional constitutional violation, right? He doesn't have to prove that he was denied his right to an impartial jury. That's not what we're saying. So, I mean, I think if this court is struggling with this idea of, well, how do we analyze this? One easy way of maybe escaping that problem is just that, obviously, the cases where we have, well, I should backtrack on that, because I do think Avery is factually similar to this case in terms of they assumed a right to counsel violation and ultimately ran a harmless error analysis that did just consider whether the remaining jurors were impartial. So I think this court's going to have to grapple with that a little bit. And obviously, I'm struggling a little bit with it, too.
In your response to one of the questions, I can't remember your word, but it was vis-a-vis what the judge asked of the juror. And essentially, my words, not yours, you posited that the judge asked, well, are you faking it? Now, that's not the word you used. You know, it was a fancier word that you used. But, you know, and the answer was no. Well, you know, what kind of advocacy is that? What do you expect a juror to say? Oh, you caught me, Judge. I am faking it. You know, so I would imagine your argument was that there wouldn't be any difference if there was no pretext was the word that you used. You know, there was no pretext. The judge asked, and there was no pretext. Well, maybe the attorney, if present, would have probed it more than the judge did. And, yes, no?
Well, I mean, they're saying this, we're very careful with jurors in terms of our questioning. So I'm not sure that I agree that had defense counsel been in the room, it would have been a more probing question. That it could, the answer could have been any more revealing. And I also don't think there, I should say, I don't think there's anything wrong with the fact that the circuit court was the one that was in charge of the questioning in this case. That happens a lot of times during voir dire, too. So I don't even know that it's a given that had defense counsel been in the room, she should have been able to ask questions. And I know we have a lot of circuit court experience on this bench, and so I don't know if that will help or hurt me, but I do urge this court to strongly look at this right to counsel issue, to carefully consider the fact that if there's minimal risk that counsel's absence in the room derogated from Mr. Spencer's right to a fair trial, it's not a critical stage. We don't have a ton of case law on things like this, so I do think the bench and bar would benefit from a decision. We're asking this court to not even get to harmless error, then you can avoid the difficult question of how do we analyze it.
Okay.
I see my light is on, and if there are no other questions, I do want to quickly pivot to the state's petition. We are, again, asking this court to make clear that a sufficiently pled post-conviction motion may be denied without a hearing where the record conclusively shows the defendant's not entitled to relief. I don't think there's a dispute between the parties that courts have the discretion to do that. I think what we're disputing is whether the lower courts are still struggling with this concept a little bit. We ran through the history in our brief of why there's been some confusion over the years. It does seem to stem from the Bentley decision. Love the Bentley decision,
oh,
by the way.
Yes, so did
love
I.
It. It's just that one sentence.
I'll
paraphrase it, but it's essentially if the motion sufficiently pled, the circuit court has no discretion and has to hold a hearing. Allen is another case that's very commonly cited in terms of what it takes to get a hearing. Allen cites to Bentley, again, for this idea that if the motion sufficiently pled, a court has to hold a hearing. This court has gone out of its way to clarify what it meant. But it seems, I will say, we still see that language a lot. I see a lot of post-conviction motions. I see a lot of arguments on appeal. And that sentence from Bentley keeps coming up, even though this court went out of its way in Howell and in Sulla to clarify the matter. So I didn't ask for this in my brief. If you want my platinum ask, it is that this court consider withdrawing that just that one sentence from Bentley and perhaps take a look at that one sentence in Allen that cites to Bentley. I think we can all agree that that's not what the court was saying, but we're still seeing that language a lot. Now, the reason we're here today is because I think it's possible that language in this court's recent Scholar opinion is being read to say that if a motion sufficiently pled, at least one alleging ineffective assistance, that a court has no discretion and has to hold a hearing. And so I think that is why we're here today, to ask this court again to make clear how this should work. And I think in taking a look at the Court of Appeals opinion, there's three possibilities of what happened here. And just as a reminder, this was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The circuit court assumes deficient performance, said, I think the record conclusively shows no prejudice. We defended that decision at the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said nothing about it in its opinion and only analyzed whether Mr. Spencer's motion was sufficiently pled and concluded for that reason the circuit court was required to hold a hearing. I think one possibility is the one that we've posited, which is we think the Court of Appeals maybe felt that its hands were tied once it found the motion sufficiently pled. We think that's wrong legally. I think we're in agreement on that. I think
I'm puzzled because they cited the Scholar decision, which I think you like, right?
Yeah, we do.
And I mean, I don't know what else the court can say. In that case, we said if a defendant's motion asserting ineffective assistance, if we're looking at that kind of a motion, if the record conclusively demonstrates the defendant is not entitled to relief, the circuit court has the discretion to grant or deny a hearing. That decision quotes from Sula. So what else can the court do?
I don't know. If you look at the opinion, the language they pulled out from Scholar says something to the effect of where a motion is summarily, where a Mockner hearing is summarily denied, the issue for the reviewing court is whether the motion is sufficiently pled. That's the language that was pulled out. And I think maybe the Court of Appeals was reading that to think that, they had to have a hearing because the motion was sufficiently pled. But as we noted, there's plenty of language in Sulla that correctly states the law. So, again, I know it's a little frustrating because I'm kind of guessing, but that's kind of my point, is that I think it's frustrating that Mr. Spencer's suggestion is that the Court of Appeals – I see my red light is on. Could I just
– finish the sentence?
I think the suggestion is that the Court of Appeals did this phantom analysis behind the scenes and disagreed with the circuit court's ruling. And we think that's entirely inappropriate because it doesn't tell the circuit court what they did wrong, and it leaves everyone guessing whether they even address the issue, which is what we're doing right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few things I'd like to say. Regarding getting back to whether counsel should have been in the room or not with the judge, one thing that I really haven't stressed, but I think it's important, is not only defense counsel wasn't in there, but the prosecution wasn't in there either. And the prosecution should have been. And I think it's evident from what happened when the court came back on the record and discussed what happened, how it would have been beneficial to have the prosecution back there. And it might have shaped the questioning of the juror at that time, because the court did not seem to realize that she could just discharge or excuse, in her words, the juror. The district attorney pointed out we have to have a finding for cause. This came up after the juror, from appearances, was already gone. And the judge had announced that she had already made her decision to excuse the juror. But district attorney took, he disagreed with the language, said we can't excuse the juror. We have to excuse her for cause, discharge her for cause, because that's what the law requires. And the district attorney said, yes, and I agree, the cause is that she's too sick. But I think if that had been apparent, it seemed as though the court didn't understand that. And if the district attorney and defense counsel had been present when these discussions were going on with the juror, it might have affected the questions. Because now you have a causal issue. It might have been a little more probing about how sick she might have been, et cetera. So I think it's not just the absence of the defense counsel that is important here. Prosecution should have been there. And I know along the way there's an argument from the state, it's one of the issues here, that it's really not important. It's not a confrontation situation because the attorney wasn't there. The prosecution wasn't there. But I'd say the prosecution should have been there. And that was wrong, and two wrongs don't make a right. And that comes from Lehman. And that's why that the procedure is spelled out in Lehman on what to do in this situation. And I don't know how the court would address these issues if it could fashion an opinion that said this was not a critical stage. Because it just, I don't see how. I didn't think that would be such a focus today. Or in the briefs, that this was, I think more of the focus is on, is it harmless error or is it structural error? The other thing, I know counsel mentioned the Avery case. Mentioned she hadn't talked about it a lot in the brief. And I hadn't looked at it again recently, but I'm trying to remember the facts. I don't think they were really similar to our case. If I remember Avery, jurors were deliberating. A juror told the bailiff, I have a child who's sick, I think, and my wife is mad at me or something about divorce. I'm trying to remember. If I have the facts wrong, I apologize. The bailiff called the judge, and then the judge called the attorneys, and they discussed what to do. And the attorney said, Judge, you can talk to the juror. The judge talks to the juror, goes back to the attorneys, and discusses, what do you want to do? And they say, well, discharge. You know, the judge explained what happened, and I believe it was all on the record. I hope, because that's what I just said. But the judge went back, discussed it with the attorneys, and they said, okay, we'll go with an alternate. So that is not the same situation that we have here. It's totally different. And getting to the Sulla, I guess, issue, I've been scratching my head a little bit to figure out what are we arguing about, and I think we're not arguing about a lot. I think the paragraph that was just cited, it says what the law is. And a judge, the reviewing court, can find that the record conclusively shows that a petitioning party is not entitled to relief. I wouldn't come down on the Court of Appeals, so to speak, for not addressing that angle. This was such a fact-intensive argument that would have been made on that. It's not the same as some of the other cases. Allen, I'm trying to remember what the facts were in Allen. It's just slipping my mind right now. Oh, there the defendant had alleged that trial counsel had not contacted a witness. But the record showed that counsel had. So you can look at the record and say that's just wrong. And then there was a Sulla, the defendant was claiming that he was misinformed about the effect of a read-in. So they looked at the record and said, no. You were. There's nothing in our motion that has been identified as wrong. No mistake. They say that the trial court conducted a thorough evaluation when it determined that our claim had no merit of the evidence. Well, the trial court didn't do that. I mean, we just disagree. The trial court, in its written decision, referred to testimony that was not part of the case. And even in their brief, the state pointed out that the trial court relied on the wrong information. A lot of the state's brief in the Court of Appeals said that we didn't plead it right. It was conclusory. And the Court of Appeals said, no, it's not. And they explained why. And I have the reasons why here, but I won't go into all that. I see my lights on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Attorney Jansen, I'm going to ask you a question.
Please.
Right out of the gate. I'm looking at the jury instruction for felony murder. Two elements. Number one, the defendant committed the crime of, here, armed robbery. And the second element is really what I'm focusing on, that the death of the victim was caused by the commission of the armed robbery in this case. What the defense is saying is that the way that the dots were connected here in this case, to the felony murder dots were connected, were through that hearsay statement. I also think it's a statement that called for speculation, but whatever, through that statement. My question is, when we're analyzing prejudice in this case, if we take away that statement that the defense has objected to, what's left for us?
That's a good question. And we did develop an analysis of why we believe that we disagree with Mr. Spencer, that the hearsay Danny shot from the window to protect me or something to that effect, that was key evidence in the state's case. There was plenty of evidence in this case that established that there was an armed robbery. It caused a shootout. ShotSpotter recorded 8 shots in a matter of seconds. It's clear from the ballistics that there were 2 shooters in 2 different locations, and based on the police investigation, the signs point to the fact that one of the shooters was in RS's kitchen window. So even without the words Danny shot to protect me, we still think there's plenty of evidence to infer that somebody was in that kitchen window, was watching this, and fired based because of the fact that there was this armed robbery going on. I don't have a lot more. There's one thing I caught that I did want to just stress, and I'll go back to the right to counsel issue because I just can't let it go. I've given you the principle from Wade that I think this court should consider, which is if there's minimal risk that counsel's absence would derogate from the defendant's right to a fair trial, it's not a critical stage. The other thing I want to highlight, which I did in my brief, is the statement from Gannon, which says that the mere occurrence of an ex parte communication between a court and a juror does not constitute the deprivation of any constitutional right. So I think to me what that says is the fact that Judge Rothstein talked to juror 2 in chambers without a lawyer present, we don't automatically just throw our arms up and say there was a constitutional violation. It has to be, we got to dig a little bit deeper, and that's what I'm asking this court to do in this case.
Counsel, on the Mockner hearing question, what's the standard of review?
So this is interesting. So the question of whether the record conclusively shows the defendant's not entitled to relief, that's a legal question. However, the case law is clear that the ultimate decision to grant or deny a Mockner hearing is a discretionary one. So it's our position that when a circuit court ultimately makes that discretionary decision to deny a hearing, the reviewing court should be searching for record for reasons to affirm that discretionary decision. Though I do recognize that the basis for the denial of the hearing is a legal question.
It's a little complicated to figure out in this context. I mean, if you have prejudice here, so there's no, you know, the trial court says no prejudice here. Is that because, based on your pleadings, you haven't made it, which is reviewed for an erroneous exercise of discretion? That or is it because the record conclusively, maybe in that situation you'd say it's because the record conclusively establishes that, and then what? Was the Court of Appeals supposed to do a de novo review of that and agree or disagree with that? Is that what the Court of Appeals should have done then in your judgment?
I think because the circuit court in this case said, based on the overwhelming evidence of guilt, the record conclusively shows no prejudice from any deficient performance, the Court of Appeals should have run the analysis themselves, because ultimately it was trying to...
What if the Court of Appeals had said, or what if the trial court had said, it's not deficient performance, that maybe there should have been an objection, but it's not deficient performance? Well, should the Court of Appeals review that determination under an erroneous exercise of discretion for failing to plead sufficiently deficient performance, or would that also be a record conclusively shows you're not entitled to relief subject to de novo review?
I think it depends on how the circuit court says there's no deficient performance. If they say, I don't think you've alleged sufficient facts to show that if you prove those facts, it constitutes deficient performance, that's one thing. But the circuit court can also say, I think the record conclusively shows, looking at other pieces in the record, that trial counsel wasn't ineffective. That would be, again, ultimately, if it's denied, I see my lights on. Ultimately, if it's denied without a hearing, then it's our position that it's a discretionary decision the court should be reviewing.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for your briefs, your argument. The court is going to recess, and that the second case gets set up. We'll be back out for that.